Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 12. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Tudor is Tony Riches. Tony was born in Pembrokeshire in West Wales and spent part of his childhood in Kenya. He gained a BA degree in psychology and an MBA from Cardiff University. After writing several successful non-fiction books, Tony decided his real interest lay in the history of the 15th and 16th centuries, and now spends much of his time writing historical fiction about the lives of key figures of medieval history. His Tudor trilogy has become an international bestseller, and he is in regular demand as a guest speaker about the lives of the early Tudors. My conversation with Tony straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Talking Tudors, Tony. How are you?
Good, yeah.
Fabulous. Now, I thought we could begin by you just sharing a little bit about yourself with us and a bit about your background as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, I live in Wales in a place called Pembrokeshire, which is on the far west of Wales by the sea.
Yes.
And I was actually born in a place called Pembroke, which is, you might know, the birthplace of Henry Tudor. And I was actually born within sight of Pembroke Castle.
Wow.
And I think that's where my connection with the Tudors really started. But it took a long time to get around to it because I had a long career in the military and in local government and in the health service. I was a director of the health service in Wales. And it was only as I was starting thinking about early retirement that I wrote my first book, which was project management of all things. I was a project manager, by the way.
Right.
And it went to number one in its category in the US.
Wow.
Amazon Kindle was new at the time, so it shows how old I am. It seems incredible, doesn't it, that it was a new thing?
Yeah.
I feel like it's always been around there, but it had. And that kind of inspired me to write my first novel, which was about 10th century Wales.
Right.
Easy to research because it was all on my doorstep.
Fantastic.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Because I found my niche in historical fiction, and I really enjoy the research possibly as much as the writing, or more than the writing.
Absolutely.
I feel like the writing is actually doing my best to recall everything I discovered on my research in some kind of narrative.
That's right, yeah. Fantastic. Now, you've mentioned your books, but I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit more about the books that you've written to do with the Tudors and obviously 15th century as well. I know you've written about that.
Yeah, well, the Tudor trilogy idea came around partly because I was researching the life of Henry Tudor.
Right.
Because a little town close to where I live, Tenby, is where they escaped to Brittany.
Yes, yes.
And so I was fascinated by the whole thing. And I started, like you do, looking for books on the subject. I found loads. I've probably got the best collection of books on Henry Tudor that's possible to have.
Right.
And the novels, he was referred to in novels and cropped up as a villain occasionally, but I couldn't find any decent novels, well-researched novels, telling his whole life story from birth to death, really.
Right.
So I saw that as a niche in the market. And then I had so much material that it would have been one of these great big doorstep books, you know, like about 800 pages more.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to have to do it as a series. And I'll have him born in the first book, mm-hmm. and then sort of coming of age in the second book, and then becoming king and eventually dying in the last book as a trilogy.
Right.
But what I hadn't realised was that there were, at the time, there were no, I hesitate to call them decent novels, there were no novels which thoroughly explored the life of Owen Tudor, or really Jasper Tudor. There were some excellent non-fiction books on Jasper Tudor.
Yes.
But I struggled to find any novels that didn't make me groan and wince when I got to the historical detail, you know?
Right.
They were reimaginings, which is absolutely fine, but not for me, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
So that kind of set out a nice little pattern for me was Owen is the first book, mm-hmm. and then Jasper. And because, of course, Henry's father, it would have been a very short book, that one, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would have.
Or like 24, you know, each chapter would be another 10 minutes of his life, sort of thing.
That's right.
And I was absolutely overwhelmed by the response, because Owen just took off, and it became the number one historical fiction book in Australia.
Wow, which that's fantastic.
For somebody sitting in my house in Templeton in Pembrokeshire, is just a bit mind-boggling, you know?
It is, absolutely. That's amazing.
It actually did the triple, because it got to number one in the US. This is on Amazon in historical fiction, by the way.
Yes.
US, UK and Australia. And so I'm still living on the success of that, because one of the amazing things about a trilogy is, as long as people like the first book, they almost automatically buy the second book, because I left it on a bit of a cliffhanger, like you're supposed
right.
to, you know?
Yes.
With, Jasper's scarpered and Owen's met his fate, kind of thing. Not a spoiler alert. And the same with the end of Jasper's story. I ended it at the Battle of Bosworth, where Henry Tudor faced an uncertain future, you see.
That's right.
So,
well, yeah.
I can actually see from my analytics that people do quite often buy all three books.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah, very good.
It is, yeah. It's from an awareness raising point of view, it means that if I promote any of the three books, then people tend to eventually get around to looking at all three. And I sat there thinking, after I finished Henry, I was really lucky, because Henry got picked up by the Amazon Storyteller Award, which I was shortlisted for, which I was quite pleased about, really, because it's a kind of external validation of what you're doing, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Although I didn't win, I was the only historical fiction book shortlisted from countless thousands. So that's
what a wonderful achievement. Yeah, that's incredible.
They gave me a bottle of champagne, and you know, I still haven't opened it yet.
Oh goodness, that wouldn't have lasted a minute in my house.
It sat in our kitchen waiting for an occasion, and my grandson was born last year, and we didn't even open it then.
Oh goodness.
So I don't know what kind of occasion it's going to be.
Yes.
But anyway, that's the idea that suddenly came to me was that I'd really enjoyed writing the part of the young Mary Tudor, who was Henry VII's youngest daughter, at her father's bedside, comforting him while his son Henry gallivanted about, basically wishing his father was dead, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd done quite a lot of research on Mary Tudor, and her story is fascinating as well, isn't it? In that,
it is, yeah.
Her brother's, one of his first acts was to have this clever diplomatic move where he married her off to the King of France.
Yes.
Which is pretty horrific by modern standards. But in those days, would have not even raised an eyebrow, would it? And in fact, Mary took it very nobly and right till her death insisted on being addressed as Mary, Queen of France, rather Duchess of Suffolk, which I always have to smile at because I think that shows something about her character, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely.
I wrote the book about Mary, but I did a load of research on her, and I went up to Bury St Edmunds, and there was a very poignant moment when have you been to Bury St Edmunds?
I have.
Yeah, standing at her tomb, which has been moved a couple of times, of course.
It has. Yeah.
But I think the most poignant moment was looking at the lock of her hair in the nearby museum.
Yes. Yeah.
And thinking that, you know, it's pretty well authenticated that really is a lock of her hair.
Right, okay.
And all of a sudden, that distance of centuries just evaporated.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I could almost feel her tangible presence.
Mm.
And when you've spent 2 years researching somebody and writing about them, that's quite an emotional moment, you know.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
I'm pleased to say that Mary, my book Mary, has been Mary Tudor Princess, has been a great success.
Oh, how wonderful.
And so I then had to think about what I was going to do next. And of course, I couldn't resist writing about her errant husband, her second husband, but her third sort of engagement, Charles Brandon.
Yes.
Best friend of Henry VIII. And, you know, it's almost impossible to not picture him as he was represented on the rather dubious television series, The Tudors.
So true, but, yeah.
He was quite different to that, of course.
Yeah.
But what we did, we went to Westhorpe as part of our research to visit his manor house, which was a very important place for both Brandon and Mary.
Yes.
And amazingly, the owner of the place, which is now an elderly residential home, the owner came out and he showed us the Tudor bridge and everything, which still exists, which Brandon would have ridden across, you know.
Oh, fascinating.
And he said, would you like to see what we got out the moat?
Right.
I said, yeah, I wouldn't mind that at all. So he took us across to a barn, and in the barn were hundreds of pieces of Mary and Brandon's manor house.
Wow.
That was just to pick up a piece of it and look at it. It was just that, once again, that was one of these moments where you think, is this really happening? You know,
that's amazing.
But anyway, my book Brandon is with my editor still.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you because I haven't seen that one out yet. So that's a new one.
It's given my editor a real challenge.
Is
because,
it?
Well, what if you imagine the stories converge halfway through. So obviously I start Brandon's story off long before he meets Mary.
Right.
He has lots of fun before that. And him growing up with the young Henry VIII, of course. Then he meets Mary. Then for several chapters, of course, their lives are lived together. So the editor has to make sure that there's absolute tie-in between the two books.
Right, okay.
So it's a cross-refer to the other book and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
But the fascinating thing, and it says a lot about the Tudors, isn't it, is that Mary was barely cold in her grave and he was off getting married again and having a whole new family again.
Yeah.
And so that would almost been a whole nother book in itself.
Yes. You've got a lot of material to work with, I think.
I'm hoping that would be ready by Christmas.
Fantastic.
But Christmas is looming large.
It is, not long now, no.
I know, so it's probably going to be early next year, because there's quite a good principle, is never rush to publication.
Right, okay.
I know there's a temptation to keep working on a book forever, isn't there?
Mm.
But there's a kind of natural point when you know that it's about as good as it's going to be.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You mustn't just go ahead with publication just because of Christmas.
No, of course not, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, fantastic. So, now, can we go back to book one for the moment of the Tudor trilogy?
Yeah.
So Owen, and you've already mentioned that explores the life of Owen Tudor, who was Henry VII's grandfather. I want to know about this legend. I've heard a legend that basically Owen pirouetted his way into the lap of Catherine of Valois. Now, it's a fantastic story, obviously, but is there any truth to it?
It's an interesting question, because I think this is a really good example of how the historical fact and the legends and the myths all get tangled up so
they
deeply
do.
That it becomes quite a challenge to untangle them. And I have actually read a book by a very reputable author that states it as fact that that happened during a drunken dance. And of course, it was hugely important to me because that's the start of the book, really, is his first meeting with, you know, how that relationship gets off the ground.
Of course.
And when I did my research, of course, it turned out that the whole thing tracks back to Michael Drayton, who was an Elizabethan poet writing a century later.
Right. Okay.
And so, you know, if you allow for 100 years difference, he wasn't actually present at the time, so he wasn't an eyewitness to it, but it was a good story. But when I started looking at it more, even more closely, I realized that he wasn't, he actually wrote, you know, since he must fall in such a place, he didn't mean it literally.
Right.
And there's a great idea of taking all this literally. There's I don't know if you have it in England, there's a and in Wales, there's an expression, something falls into your lap.
Yes, yes.
They don't mean it literally falls into your lap.
Through
a combination of circumstances, you happen to be in the right place at the right time, and there's an element of luck involved. You know? And there's another bit in that the Chronicle of London by William Gregory, he was mayor of London, and he said that Owen's last words were about that was want to lie in Catherine's lap.
Right.
And once again, that's not meant literally, but people just go along with it,
right,
like a lot of things. And the fact of the matter is that Owen Tudor was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Through his connections, he ended up at Windsor Castle looking after the jewels of a lonely young widowed queen.
Right.
And he was a handsome young Welsh chap, not particularly attached to anybody at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in Parliament had made it their business to make sure as best as they could that Queen Catherine didn't bump into any likely suitors, you know?
Yes, yeah.
So she was lonely. I'm sure you've been to Windsor Castle. It's a massive, rambling place. Lots of secret little corners.
Absolutely, yes.
So that was my starting point. I like the story, but it actually does a bit of a disservice to both Queen Catherine and to Owen, because it suggests that they were just it was just a drunken affair. You know?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Of course, we know that it was much more enduring than that.
Absolutely. And, All right, great. Thanks for clarifying that. That's fantastic. Now, the second book in the trilogy is about Jasper Tudor. So he was Henry VII's uncle. Now, I've seen him quite sort of frequently described as elusive. And there was even an article I read that sort of compared him to a kind of 007 character, you know, sneaking into castles to fight, sneaking out again in disguise and that sort of thing. What do the sources tell us about Jasper? Do we know much about him?
That's interesting because, first of all, like Owen, there are no reliable images of him or even descriptions of him. Any that you might have seen, if you look at them closely enough, they're probably Victorian,
right,
like the famous stained glass windows in Cardiff Castle, which were commissioned by the Marquess of Bute. And so he would have asked the artist to do his best to represent a handsome young knight of Tudor times, you know?
Yeah.
So it's almost like a kind of, not a caricature, it's almost just like a fanciful imagination of what he's like.
Mm-hmm.
But what the records tell us was that Jasper Tudor somehow escaped from the Battle of Mortimer's Cross to live another day.
Right.
Now, if you think about it, he had three choices. None of them were great.
Yeah.
The first one, fight to the death,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So that's quite a noble way of ending things. They're horribly outnumbered, of course, and the whole thing was a fiasco. And, you know, all credit to Edward that he really had it planned out well.
Mm.
The second thing he could have done was surrendered. He could have laid down his sword. But we all know what happens when you're surrendering to the Yorkists. There's a fairly certain outcome of that. Mm. He would have got his head chopped off.
Exactly.
Which, once again, isn't great, is it?
It's not.
The third option, which is the one that I believe he actually took, was to run as fast as he could, scattering his weapons and armor as he went, mm-hmm. and keep his head down for a while. Right. And that's where my book Jasper really begins, mm-hmm. is he's on the run from a very powerful army, from the king, and then he was no great military expert, because he would take audacious risks attacking castles and all sorts of things, quite often with inadequate research and resources. So they didn't even know what they were going to find when they got there, you know.
Right.
And each time he gets away by running away. So it is really a story about, like, the man who got away.
Right.
It must have troubled him, because I think he was quite a noble person. And, you know, he had good values, because there's lots of examples. It's fascinating to read the records of when he was effectively the justice of the peace in this area.
Right.
And there are the records of that, which you can find in the Welsh journals. And he seems to have been a very fair man. Mm. And he took it upon himself to give his life to protecting and helping his brother's son.
Yes.
So he became Henry Tudor's real guardian in the fullest sense of the word.
Mm.
And I think that's all credit to him for that.
All right, fantastic. Now, just staying on Jasper for a moment, I suppose popular fiction has us kind of believe that there was something going on with Jasper and Margaret Beaufort. Have you found anything to suggest that there was sort of any kind of romantic involvement there, or is that just all make-believe?
I read it in a book by Philippa Gregory.
Yeah, so, and they've put it in a few different
movies. No, seriously. I've researched this as thoroughly as I could, mm-hmm. and I found nothing whatsoever. She was very devout.
Yes, she
and,
was.
And she was married off pretty much straight away after Henry Tudor's birth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever we might think about the Tudors' morals, it would give her difficulty as such a devout woman.
Yes,
if she was up to no good with her
her brother-in-law.
Yeah, I have to think what the relationship was.
Yeah.
But also he was pretty busy as well. He was trying to defend Pembroke Castle against the Yorkist attack and everything like that. So it probably, on the balance of probabilities, mm-hmm. is that he thought of her like a sister.
Right, okay, yep.
She was his sister-in-law, and he thought of her like a sister. Mm-hmm. He would have very much done anything for her, possibly even laid down his life to defend her,
mm.
and very much taken her advice, because she was very politically astute.
Yes,
of course,
she was, yeah. Well.
And so it does annoy me a little bit when I see her made to be a villainess or whatever.
Yeah.
But then that's up to people's choice to make their own decisions, isn't it?
Exactly.
But if anybody's got any doubt, I recommend that they read the translations of her letters.
Okay.
Which really do give a sense of her character as well.
Oh, that's good. That's a good tip there. Now, a couple of months ago, I was actually browsing your blog, because you also have a blog that's called The Writing Desk, and I came across a really fantastic series that you'd written called The Tudor's Road to Bosworth. Now, I find this such a fascinating subject, and I'd love it if you could sort of firstly tell us about what inspired you to write this series, and secondly, if you could talk to us a little bit, obviously, about Henry Tudor's journey from exile to the throne of England.
Yes, well, the credit for this goes to Nathan Amin, who you might know.
Yes, I know
He's
Nathan.
Written an excellent book about the Beauforts. And he told me, because I meet him occasionally, because he's from this part of the world.
That's
and
true.
He told me that he'd followed in their footsteps to Brittany. And we love Brittany, so it seemed like a perfect combination of things was to go to remote Brittany and find the chateaus where the Tudors were, you see.
Yes.
So we started off at Pembroke Castle, which is where they began, and it was only 10 miles away to Tenby, where some people say that they escaped through secret tunnels underneath the streets to the harbour.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that the entrance to those tunnels was underneath the what used to be Thomas White's house, the mayor of Tenby at the time.
Right.
And that's now a chemist's shop. So we went into the chemist and asked for the manager. And she said, yeah, I'm happy to show you. Have you got a torch?
Right.
So she took us down to the basement, which was cavernous. It's an enormous basement, far too big for something like that. It used to be a wine merchant's cellar, I suppose.
Right.
And there was a piece of hardboard laying against one wall, about 6 foot by 4 foot. And she pulled it away, and there was the entrance to the secret tunnel.
She
took us down there. We borrowed a torch. And it was fascinating because it wasn't just one tunnel, it was a network of tunnels. And one of them went under the road across to the church, and another one led down towards the harbour. So I believe there's really good evidence that if they had to escape, the town of Tenby was occupied by Yorkists, and it was dreadful because you didn't know who was friend or enemy.
Right.
And the Yorks would pay a lot of money if somebody tipped them off that the Tudors were about to escape to the harbour. So the only time they could do it would be at night and through these tunnels. If they did it in broad daylight, they'd have to be disguised, and it was high risk, you see. And interestingly, as we went down the tunnel, I found an ancient fireplace. There would be no reason to build a fireplace down there unless people were going to stay down there for any length of time. And it had a proper chimney and everything, but in the fireplace were medieval glass bottles.
Oh, goodness, how exciting.
Still there
several
centuries ago. I was tempted to liberate one, but I've left it exactly as it was. But I've read since that people have put that it is thought that there are tunnels under Tenby. I can tell you for a fact that there are photographs of them on my blog.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Anyway, we've actually sailed quite often from Tenby, and including at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you it's quite a dangerous way to go round Land's End, which is a dangerous, rocky shoreline where countless ships have been wrecked.
Right.
And so we decided to take the ferry from Portsmouth when we were following in their footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have sailed across in a small Tudor ship, and they got blown off course and ended up on Jersey, which you can actually see Jersey from the coast of Brittany.
Right.
Okay. So you can see how they ended up there. And then, of course, they were promptly arrested by the Duke of Brittany's men as soon as they landed.
Mm.
And we actually followed in their footsteps all the way through from the coast right through to the beautiful castle at Sassinio. I don't know if you've ever been there, but
no, I haven't.
Amazingly, what the French have done, I think we could do that in this country a little bit, is they've reconstructed the ruined medieval castle
to be as
it might have looked in Jasper Tudor's time.
Right. Okay.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's wonderful.
It's in the middle of nowhere, but there's a constant procession of school visits. You know, great big coaches keep pulling up, and French school children are all going there to learn about the Tudors.
How fantastic. And
in our country, in Wales, most people don't have a clue about it, which is quite funny, isn't it?
Right.
But what happened was that the Duke of Brittany realised that they could easily be kidnapped from the beach, because there's a beautiful beach which is very similar to the beach at Tenby, within a 5 minutes walk of Sassinio Castle. So they split them up, and they put Jasper in Jocelyn Chateau and then Henry in the forest. It's way in the middle of nowhere, and we only found it because of our sat nav.
Right, yeah.
Went to both of them. The one in Jocelyn is a the French pronounce it Juice Land, but I call it Jocelyn. But we stayed within sight of the castle, so we had the same views that Jasper might have had. So when I was writing about the time that he spent there, I was actually recalling the actual views that I could see.
Oh, that's amazing.
So there was a row of ruined medieval cottages within his line of sight and an ancient bridge. So I was able to really work out the geography of it all, you know.
That's fantastic.
The fascinating one was when I went to La Foret, which is the chateau in the forest where Henry Tudor stayed as a young man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually falling down, but it says you can enter at your own risk.
Right.
And Henry Tudor Tower, and you know these spiral staircases?
Yes, yes.
So few people go up there that it's all covered in cobwebs. My wife said, "You're covered in cobwebs." I didn't mind, because we actually stood in the room where Henry Tudor would have lived in exile.
Wow.
Which was one of those amazingly evocative moments that when you're actually writing about it, you know, you can really visualize the sounds of the forest. Smells, it's slightly damp smelling place, you know.
Right.
But you know, then of course what happened was they had the first of their not terribly successful invasions of Britain.
Yes.
And so the rest of it sort of was quite a different story again. But fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating. Sorry, continue.
If anybody's interested,
yeah.
There are posts about all of those visits with photographs on my blog, because I thought that more people should know about it, really.
Absolutely, and not everyone can travel there, so that's a really good way of seeing it and experiencing it, I suppose. That's great. Were you going to add something else, sorry, about the journey?
Yeah, is that as well as the historical dimension of it, it's just a beautiful, beautiful holiday.
Right.
Which takes in some of the nicest parts of old Brittany,
mm-hmm.
not the tourist trail, really.
Right. Mm.
Although Jocelyn is a perfectly preserved medieval village with a lot of tourists, they couldn't even understand my schoolboy French because they speak a kind of ancient Breton, and I had to have somebody at another table help me order a beer, you know.
Right, yeah, gosh.
I'm miming it. But I recommend it to anybody, and definitely to make the trip down to Sicinio. That's beautiful.
That sounds fantastic. I'm adding that to my list, definitely. Now, like you, Tony, I love, obviously, walking in the footsteps of the Tudors, and, you know, I often head overseas for that exact purpose. But I wanted to know, what are some of your sort of favourite historic sites in Wales associated with the Tudors or not, even just some of your favourites?
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's basically any of the castles. I mean, one for your bucket list, I don't know if you've done this, is to go to Harlech Castle and to climb the battlements.
That sounds good.
That is, you have to have nerves of steel for that, because the safety railings are at knee height.
Oh, yeah.
There is a 300 foot sheer drop to the rocks below. And if it's a windy day, the wind tries to push you over the drop. You know?
Oh, goodness.
So that's a good one.
That is a good one.
I think I have to confess that my favourite is Pembroke Castle. I mean, it's only 20 minutes from where I live.
Oh, how fantastic.
It's really well preserved. The thing that used to frustrate us was that there was so little real acknowledgement of the importance of Henry Tudor. There's a strange little sort of group of waxworks in one of the towers, which is purported to be the birth of Henry Tudor.
Yes, I've seen pictures. Yeah.
It shows Margaret Beaufort as a middle-aged woman.
Right.
she was 14 or 15 at the time, depending on. Yes, probably more like 14.
Yeah.
And across the road in the church, there is a nice stained glass window commemorating Henry as king.
Right.
But that was it. So a group of us got together in Pembroke Town. And we raised the money for a statue of Henry Tudor to go on the bridge in front of the castle.
Yes, I saw it. It's beautiful.
You've seen it. It's magnificent.
In photos, not in person, but just in photos.
That's next time you visit Wales, I recommend that, because
definitely.
We positioned it so that you can photograph it with the castle in the background with a nice sunset.
Right.
And nobody leaving or entering Pembroke can be any doubt now of the importance of Henry Tudor and the fact that he was born there. Mm-hmm. And it's become a real tourist spot. And the nice thing is we found the money to build a little picnic area around it with picnic benches. And that families go there in the summer now to sit on the bridge. That was a place you never would have chosen to sit in the past, the way. And they're all... We wanted to take a photo of the statue for my blog, and there were so many people taking photos that we couldn't. We had to wait in a queue. So that's a real result. And the statue was made by a local sculptor called Harriet Adiman, who lives just down the road from where I live. Mm-hmm. And it was cast in a local foundry. So it's very much a Pembrokeshire thing. And I'd like to think that if either Owen, Jasper or Henry came back to Pembroke Castle, they'd be quite pleased to see that.
That's a fantastic thing. What a great achievement. Fantastic. Yeah, I definitely need to add that to my list to see that. Now, Tony, we're coming to the end of our conversation, but I wanted to know, are you ready to play a little game of 10 to go?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned the bucket list. What are two items that are on your bucket list?
Well, I'm now writing about the court of Elizabeth I.
Okay.
And I started off with Francis Drake, who is a fascinating character. Mm. And I've been doing loads and loads of research. And I spoke recently to an author that actually went to Venezuela followed in Drake's footsteps when he was attacking the Spanish gold. They call them mule trains that they brought gold and silver across. And he happily was leading men to steal all of their gold and silver.
Goodness.
And that's one I'd like to do. And I've also developed an interest as well in Mary, Queen of Scots, the truth behind the stories. And I really would like to follow in her footsteps a bit more as well. So that would definitely include another trip back to France, wouldn't it?
It would, and, definitely.
Scotland. I've been to Scotland, but I've never really visited any castles there. So that's one I'm planning when I can get around to it.
Right, and there are fabulous castles there, actually, fabulous.
Yeah.
So what's an early childhood memory that you have?
Well, I grew up in Africa, in Kenya.
Oh, right,
and,
okay.
And I was there during the Mau Mau Rebellion.
Right, okay.
Against, it shows how old I am now, doesn't it? Basically, our house got attacked by the Mau. And we were in danger of getting massacred because we were the British imperialists.
Right.
Father was there with the Royal Air Force.
Right.
And we should never have been in the country, quite honestly. Mm. Looking back at the time, I didn't know any different.
No.
But my mother told me afterwards that she thought it was the end, you know.
Right.
And she was throwing things at them in desperation to get them to leave.
Mm.
And by some miracle, they decided our house was too complicated and they went on an attack next door instead.
Oh, goodness.
And the strange thing is, we went back to Kenya on our anniversary, on a big anniversary, and we went back to Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
And where I used to live is all now the University of Nairobi.
Right.
So I remember it as wide open spaces and fields and stuff, you know, and it's now a university campus.
Goodness, okay.
So life goes on, doesn't it?
It does.
I think that's good for Nairobi.
Yeah, that sounds good, definitely. So I'm sure you're probably reading lots of things at the moment, but what's one book that you're reading at the moment?
It's a great big doorstep of a book called, I can't remember the full title. It's Amy Licence's book on Anne Boleyn.
Oh, yes. I haven't read that one yet, but it's on my list as well.
Well, it just raises so many questions. And I think if there's a test of a book, as well as holding your attention, if it raises questions and challenges the previously held ideas, then that's a good book, isn't it?
That's good.
And so I'm enjoying it. And it's just such a heavyweight thing, you know, if I need,
yes.
If I've got a wobbly piano, it'll be very handy. No, but it's a great book, and it's one I recommend already, although I'm only halfway through it so far.
Okay, great, fantastic. Let's see. So what's your ideal Saturday night like? What do you like to do to relax?
That's interesting. We've got a boat on the river quarter of an hour's drive from here. And the river is the Clyddo, and it goes all the way down to Pembroke Castle into the sea.
Oh, lovely.
And there's nothing better than a beautiful evening sail on the river where all you can hear, because it's so remote, all you can hear are the curlews. So we've named our yacht Curlew.
Oh,
and every once in a while, all of the planets are in the right alignment, that the tides are right, the wind is not too strong, you know, we're available, and we can just go down there and just drift off down the river. And it's just beautiful.
Oh, that sounds so relaxing. That sounds really lovely. What does your writing space look like?
I laugh because I bought myself a splendid writing desk with my royalties. With a, you know, the sort with a, it's got a fold-down piece with a green leather.
Oh, yes,
cover,
yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Lots of little cubby holes. And I imagined that I'd be sat there studiously writing, and that would be my writing space. And you know, the truth is that I have a laptop, it's a MacBook Pro, and I start off sometimes desperately writing down dialogue that's come to me in my sleep,
right,
before I get out of bed. It's a strange thing, if you go to sleep wondering how you're going to solve a problem with dialogue, I find that I can wake up with it all in my head,
right,
and I have to desperately capture it as quickly as I can. I've tried handwriting it, and then I have the problem of remembering, working out what I wrote.
Yeah.
My handwriting is quite like a doctor's handwriting. So I type it straight in, and then the laptop follows me around wherever I go. It's got a really long battery life. So my writing space now is wherever I can find this. Quiet space on my laptop, which is nice because we've got a nice conservatory, which is a beautiful place to write, and I can just write in the lounge or whatever, you know. So
yeah, that's good.
That works for me.
Excellent. Now, are there any new skills that you'd like to learn?
Oh gosh, the one of my great regrets is that I never did Latin at school.
Oh yes, yeah.
And do you know? So often, did you do Latin?
No, I didn't, and I really need someone that knows Latin at the moment.
You know exactly how I feel then, because you stand in somewhere amazing like Westminster Abbey, looking at these Latin inscriptions, and you have to rely on somebody else's interpretation of them,
exactly.
Which I have found is not always correct.
No, that's right.
Because there's so much scope in Latin to interpret it in different ways, that they can interpret it according to their own cultural position, you know. But so that's one thing I'd like to do. And I'd also like to, I think I'm a wannabe historian now, in that I would like to understand more about how to do proper historical research.
Yeah.
And I've now reached the point where I realise that it's really quite a complicated business.
I think so, yes.
There's much more to it than just getting hold of an original document, and you need to understand everything around it, don't you? The whole context, who wrote it, why they wrote it. And so you never stop learning, do you? So that's just a couple of examples of skills I really need right now.
Excellent. Yeah, I totally agree with you on the Latin. That would be very handy. What was your first paid job?
First paid job, I was in the Royal Air Force.
Okay.
I actually followed my father's career, which I think a lot of sons do, don't they?
Yes.
And my brother did the same, is that I joined the Royal Air Force almost without thinking. I think I had a careers advisor. I remember a turning point in my life was a careers advisor said, what plans have you got for the future? I said, I'll join the Royal Air Force. And he's fine. And that was the end of the discussion.
Right.
I kind of sleepwalked my mate into the Air Force, and I was in there for 10 years.
Fantastic.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's amazing life. And I did all sorts of things that most people would never even have the chance to do ever, you know.
Yeah.
But then what happens in the UK is when you're 30, you can either sign on until you're 40,
right,
or you can live with a lump sum.
Oh,
and
okay.
A lot of people happily sign on until they were 40. Then nobody wanted to employ them.
Mm.
The skills were all about how to fly airplanes and stuff. So I took a huge risk and just left the Air Force at 30, and I tried various things. I worked in I helped to privatise the British Gas, which was one of the big utilities, and that was a baptism of fire. I did an MBA, by the way, so I that was how I turned the corner in terms of my business knowledge, and then I became a director of the Health Service in Wales, which I've mentioned. So, I followed various things like that. I ran my own consultancy company for a while, which took me all over Europe. That was fascinating because it's just you and a pen, and if you can earn a living and pay your mortgage just armed with a pen,
That's quite amazing, yeah.
that's quite good, isn't it?
That is really good.
Of course, you don't get any paid holidays. So in the end, I joined the local authority and I became head of planning in Cardiff Council. And that was quite fun as well. So I was part of regenerating the city centre. And I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of Cardiff Bay, but we based it on Boston waterfront. And that's transformed. I suddenly realised that I really wanted to be a full-time author, and I think I meant the turning point was realising that the mechanisms were there through Amazon to do it. And so that's what I did. A little bit of a gamble,
Yeah,
but
but it's paid off for you, so that's
yes.
fantastic. All right, great. What's a memorable piece of advice that you've been given at some point in your life?
Oh gosh,
Or a good piece of advice?
Oh, there's so many. I think I'll keep it simple and related to what I do now, which is that, and I can't even remember who said this originally now, but it was that if you write one page a day, then that's a book a year.
Yeah, that's
And
true, isn't it? Gosh.
an amazing thought. People say to me, oh, I'm far too busy to write a book. I couldn't possibly do it, And you know how long it takes to write one page. I mean, I can write one page without even thinking about it, probably edit half of it out again. But if that was all that you did, then at the end of the year, you'd have a book which you could send off to an editor or you begin the process,
Yeah, that's right. That's inspiring. Yeah, that's really good. And lucky last. So, what's one of the first words, I suppose, that comes to mind when you hear the name Henry Tudor? What comes to mind?
Dear tyrant.
Yeah,
It's
okay.
what came straight into my mind.
Yeah, that's,
And
yeah, I've got to say the first thing, that's how this game works.
I chose deliberately not to write about Henry Tudor, Henry VIII.
Henry the Eighth, yeah.
But my next podcast is going to be about him. So I'm currently researching, trying to find some fresh views
Okay,
on him. And of
great.
course, I've written about him as a young boy. And I quite enjoyed doing that because I had lots, there are quite a few good books now about the young Henry. And it gives you a completely different view of him. And of course, there is so much nonsense written about him, which can take into account the things I mentioned about the historical context and the Tudor view of the world. And, even things like it was the Pope that named him Defender of the Faith. People think that he arrogantly claimed the title as his own. And it's quite ironic, isn't it, that it was the Pope's idea to call him that. So, tyrant, for all of the good things that he did, like sort out those monasteries that were taking over the world, he did execute more people during his reign than any other king.
Well,
So,
I have read that. I've never sort of checked the facts myself, but I have read that, yeah.
I can pretty much confirm that here
Oh,
and
good.
now.
Okay.
There's well, or I can challenge you to find a king
Yeah.
that executed
I think
more. That's an
okay.
interesting one.
So how many do you think roughly?
Gosh,
Because I've
it's in
seen
the hundreds.
yeah.
Yeah,
So
because
hundreds?
there's the well-known ones. It's three figures, but there's the well-known ones. But then he ordered lots of executions on top of that, didn't he? So, or he was culpable in that he didn't stop them.
No, well, that's exactly right, yeah.
So, there's a side to him which is quite tyrannical, I think. I really enjoy the Shard Lake books, C.J. Sampson's books, and the later ones give a really amusing picture of Henry VIII being lowered into his chair on chains, you know?
Right.
Because he can't hardly move a muscle because he's so corpulent. And I just think that's quite intriguing, really.
Oh, no, such a contrast from the young Henry, isn't it? With him being carried around the palaces and, you know, all that sort of thing at the end. All right, fantastic. Now, Tony, do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
A Tudor takeaway, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, so just a little gem that we can all go off and explore after this.
Yes, here's a little gem, which you may actually know about, but some people might not know about.
Yeah.
One of the most amazing sources that I've found over the years, and I've been doing this for years now, 10 years, is British History Online, the letters and papers of Henry VIII. And so if people Google that, if you just type in British History Online, BHO, Letters and Papers, Henry VIII, it's fascinating because it's organized chronologically. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of curious documents. Most of them are translated into English, which, as I said, I desperately need. Some of them are still in the original Latin, which is even more intriguing. And there are things like letters from Wolsey to... I don't know, the Pope or something like that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And some of them are like almost shopping lists of things that Henry needs to go on progress.
Yeah.
And there's just such a wealth of compelling detail that it's like lifting the lid on the Tudor world, and you find all this real life stuff that is very relatable, you know?
Absolutely.
Henry, yards of cloth Henry the Seventh wanted for his daughter's wedding and stuff like that, and what type it must be and all. Yeah, I've relied on it quite heavily because I think that they've done an honest job of interpreting. There's no interpretation really, other than translation. It's just given to you with the dates from and to, you know, or records of court or parliament and stuff. And so the only trouble with it is you start looking for something because it's all searchable and you so easily get sidetracked.
That's right. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
An hour can pass and you think, what did I come here looking for? You know, it is an amazing gift, people like me. The libraries around here are pretty dire. I've got the National Library of Wales in Aberystwyth, but that's like a 2 or 3 hour drive from here.
Right. Okay.
And so to be able to just sit on my laptop and type in Henry's progress on a certain date and get the actual letters relating to it on screen in a moment is wonderful.
It really is. And you can lose yourself in there for hours, as you say. Very easy thing to do. All right. Well, Tony, thank you so much for taking the time out of, I know this is your writing time, to chat with me. I really appreciate it. And it's been really, really interesting. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.